Every single mythological story that our listeners might know about has multiple versions. And most of the Greek mythology that we know about is written down during what is basically called the Golden Age of Greece. And so the Greeks that are writing this down are trying to portray Greece in a certain light. But in fact, those stories come from an oral tradition that was not written down, sometimes thousands of years. These are all different versions of the same story. Finally, one of them gets to the top, rises to the top.
What makes a story last for thousands of years to the point where something that the Greeks told each other gets turned into a corporate logo? This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today, we're talking with Heartland Community College professor who is sharing Greek mythology stories for three different generations of students.
I am Tom McCulley, and I teach humanities and Greek mythology at Heartland Community College.
You have a unique role in that you teach traditional courses, four-credit courses, you know, traditional college students of all ages. But you also teach these continuing education courses, or you have, which are not for credit and are for people that want to just learn something and make their life better. And you teach kids at Heartland courses for, you know, K through 12 kids in that range as well. Now, those are three completely different sort of, for lack of a better word, audiences. First of all, what motivated you to do that and to reach out beyond your regular classroom?
Yes, somebody asked me to do it, and I tend to like to say yes, especially if I'm going to have the opportunity to speak about things I truly love. And Greek mythology is something I truly love, and so I love speaking about it. I was approached by the adult ed people because I had a previous life in this world. I used to run the garlic press, as you know, Steve. I know a lot of people in the public community, and they thought, oh, we'll put Tom McCulley's face out there, and people will know who he is, and they'll come. And it was great fun to speak to the adult learners. This will be my first time in July that I will be working with K-12. I'll be working with junior high students, and primarily that'll be 1 3-hour session. We'll be talking about Percy Jackson, the Percy Jackson books, the Percy Jackson movie, the series, a little bit about Disney, and then how those relate to actual Greek mythology.
You have a love of Greek mythology. Yes. How did that start? When did you embrace that? What captured your interest and fascination with Greek mythology?
I always believe in sharing about the gifts of my teachers in the past. And so he has left us, but Dr. John Shields from Illinois State University, when I was studying mostly writing, that's where most of my degree focus has been, and things like trauma theory, he introduced me to Greek mythology, and I took several classes within Greek mythology. Things that surprised my credit students here, because like a whole entire semester on the Odyssey and the Aeneid, right, an entire semester on the Trojan War. And yes, those are worth an entire semester. They really are. And so big, huge, deep dives with him into Greek mythology. But I have always loved Greek mythology going back to my junior high and high school years. Some of those early kind of sword and sandal movies that had to do with Greek mythology. I've always enjoyed reading mythology. I love seeing mythological ideas pop up in fiction stories or in poetry. So I think it's always been with me, really, probably since high school.
So you said something a little bit ago that is interesting. You talked about how you connected with Dr. Shields, and also you mentioned that you worked at the Garlic Press.
Yes,
I did. It's appropriate, I think, that you're teaching some of these adults learners, not for credit, because you have this history of really lifelong education. There was a gap for you between you got your bachelor's degree and then many years later came back, got your master's and pursued that. What prompted that?
Well, there's a 20 plus year gap between my bachelor's degree and my master's degree. In that time, I lived in Chicago for a while, and then I came back and was lucky enough to be hired at the Garlic Press and worked there for 18 years before I came back. Part of when I first came back, I thought I would pursue my master's in creative writing, and I began to go back to school at Illinois State University, and another amazing mentor, Dr. Lucia Getze. She would come into the Garlic Press, and she would just talk to me and say, oh, you need to come take a creative writing class, and I did, and she was very supportive of my writing, and she really wanted me to start graduate school, and I was not ready. Right, I really was enjoying my life at the Garlic Press. I was settling in with my family, and raising a daughter. When it came time at the garlic press to decide that I would stay and become a partner, or that it was probably time to leave if I wasn't going to make that choice, I looked up one day when she was in the garlic press and said, Lucia, you're right. I would love to come back to school again. And she opened many doorways for me and made it possible for me to do that. So then I finished that degree. I'm sorry to brag, my thesis won the thesis award at Illinois State University. And then I came to work at Heartland full time. And I was doing that, teaching writing, having a great time. But then ISU kept calling saying, well, you should come and do your doctorate. Another 7 years to say, okay, I will come and do my doctorate. Another beautiful mentor, Dr. Cass Fleischer, and I was able to be hooded by her. 10 years after my master's, I completed my PhD.
You know, it's always interesting. We think of people that have their PhDs being this very learned folks, but some of them, they went straight through, and they're learned at 25, 26 years old. What do you think you brought to the classroom from having the life experience on top of your formal education?
So many answers there. My number one right now that I'm enjoying is I can look at my students and go, oh, you're the age of my grandsons right now. And one of my grandsons who will remain anonymous or he would kill me is here as a student right now. And not all of their teachers can look at them and say, yes, my grandchildren are your age. That was part of it. Having run a business meant I had a whole different perspective on life and what it means in the day-to-day grind of figuring out budgets and figuring out how to stock things and how to sell things and how to talk to people. That gave me a lot of experience there. Being two gay men raising a daughter at a time when that was extremely unusual in the 80s going into the 90s certainly gave me a certain kind of compassionate toughness, because we were always very proud to hold our family up as an exemplar, and mostly to say we're just like other families. And I would say, for me, going back to mythology are stories that carry life lessons, moral lessons, practical cultural lessons, but they're stories in the end. And all of those experiences made me a storyteller. So I think I can come to the classroom as a storyteller.
Well, and that leads me to the role of humanities and the role of telling these ancient stories that have, you know, they've resonated, and connecting those stories to the life experience of college students. What are some examples that you might have of how you are connecting these stories, pick any one or overall, to day-to-day life and the things that people will experience as they head out of college or head to that next stage?
Sure. There's a couple of easy ones. One that most people would recognize is the story of Medusa. And Medusa is so often portrayed in media as a monster. And Medusa was anything but a monster. She actually began as a very, very beautiful woman who unfortunately was assaulted by the god Poseidon. And then the goddess Athena chose to blame her and not him, and turned her into the Medusa from a beautiful woman, the woman with the snake hair and the eyes that turn you to stone. But now today, with especially the Me Too movement, you will see women who have undergone tough experiences using the Medusa tattoo as a sign of fierceness. And I teach them that even that, at the end of the day, Perseus, who slew Medusa, gave her head to Athena, who used it on her shield as a war protector, as something that you run away from. And Medusa's head is used on ancient gravestones to ward off evil and to say, don't rob my grave. Bad things will happen to you. And then young woman today wearing the Medusa head as a sign of defiance, saying, okay, the other thing Medusa did was stopped you from assaulting her because she turned you into stone. So they relate to that a great deal. I mean, that's an easy one. Do you want more?
Yeah, I do. But I also want to point out, you know, Versace.
And Versace
adopted that Medusa symbol for the same reasons, probably.
Versace adopted the Medusa symbol to talk about fierce beauty. Our things, this is Versace speaking, right? Our items are so amazing that you won't be able to look away from them, but they'll scare you too because of how wonderful they are, right? It was a great ploy.
See, you know, I think that you might have had maybe business or marketing-minded young people moving into these classes that would have never even, they would love to hear that story. And
very true. They would not have thought of that. But, you know, I used those, that the idea of the logo. The logo is also what I used in my adult class that I taught here at Heartland to the adult learners in continuing education. part of what we did that day was go through the various logos that are still in use today that come directly out of Greek mythology that people use for marketing. So
that is interesting because I think that there are certain things, if somebody says, I made a Herculean effort to do X or Y, that's still enough in our common culture that we understand what Hercules is doing, or at least that why it's a Herculean effort, right?
Yes, yes. But
there are probably a lot of other things that you talk about in the class that come from that same beginning of a Greek story, a Greek myth, that we've lost that thread of what people commonly say or do or use.
What they come from, yes, yes, I think so as well. We talk a lot about the moral dilemma that faces cultures when things don't go exactly the way that you think they are. And one of the favorite activities that my students participate in is King Minos of Crete, also seen as a very evil man because he is the one who ordered 12 or 14 young Athenians every couple of years to be sacrificed to the Minotaur, the half-bull, half-man, to be eaten in the labyrinth. And we make that connection with them. First of all, they just learned about the labyrinth and where does the labyrinth come from and what does it mean to be put into the maze? And then you think of the maze runner of the stories that they're used to today. But also we look at why did Minos make this choice? Was he really a monster? And the fact is that in Greek mythology, he makes the choice because when his young son, Androgeus, goes to Athens from Crete to participate in the pre-Olympic Games, they weren't the Olympic Games yet, he wins every single award that you can win. But, you know, he's from this little island of Crete, right? A Cretan from Crete. And he wins everything. And the jealous Athenians, in at least one version, have him killed because of that. And so Minos wants retribution. And his retribution is to call for the sacrifice of young people. So my students put Minos on trial for crimes against humanity. And they use the Greek morality, the Greek culture, as one way of looking at it. And then they use ideas from today's idea of morality and culture. And they have to combine those things. And part of my class is the prosecution, part is the defense, part is the jury, and part are the witnesses. And they put Minos on trial. And sometimes he's found guilty and sometimes he's found innocent. I don't have any control over that. But
is he more often found innocent than guilty or guilty than innocent?
To be honest, it's about half and half.
It's about 50-50.
They really sometimes cannot decide.
You mentioned something in there about how different tellings of the story have different details or maybe even different outcomes. That's not something I necessarily think about with Greek mythology, of it having different iterations. Of course, a lot of these sorts of things do, and they change over the years. How often do you find that where you get a different version of the story, not counting all the Disney versions we might talk about?
Well, going back first into ancient Greece, and the answer is every single mythological story that our listeners might know about has multiple versions. And most of the Greek mythology that we know about is written down during what is basically called the Golden Age of Greece. And so the Greeks that are writing this down are trying to portray Greece in a certain light. But in fact, those stories come from an oral tradition that was not written down, sometimes thousands of years before the Golden Age of Greece really writes down the versions that I tell my student, the one that rises to the top, the one that finally gets published, to say it that way. But if you think about the Demeter story, there is 100 versions of the Demeter story. The Greeks, we think of the city-states, we think of them as the birthplace of democracy, but these city-states were still fiercely independent places. So the Demeter story in Athens, in Sparta, in Thessalonia, these are all different versions of the same story. Finally, one of them gets to the top, rises to the top. And so when we take these stories today, like through Percy Jackson, or Disney, of course, is going to clean up these stories, it has to, and we say, well, are they corrupting them? My response to anyone who says that is absolutely not. These are corrupted stories before the ones that you read in high school or junior high school that you ever saw in the first place. Think of a 1,000-year-old game of telephone, right? They had been spoken for 1,000 years before they got written down.
Are your students ever surprised to learn the origin of some of the things they might be familiar with from other stories, from other religious iterations, from other things they may have heard? Oh, that's the same story. It's just a different version that the Greeks were telling.
Sure. The easiest of all there's two easy comparisons. In Greek mythology, there's a flood story. In Judeo-Christianity, there's a flood story. In Egypt, there's a flood story. in Southeast Asia, there's a flood story. That goes back to our friend Joseph Campbell, who explored mythologies across the world. We know that there are multiple versions of the flood story. But even the basic hero template of Jason or Theseus or Perseus, or for the Greeks it was Heracles, not Hercules, but of Heracles, the earlier template for that actually comes out of Mesopotamia through Gilgamesh. And we know that the Greeks didn't have the written version of Gilgamesh, but they had the oral stories, because you can see it picked up in all of the Greek hero stories. And so they learn that. They learn that those stories really do come from a much older tradition.
You mentioned that you're going to be teaching Percy Jackson's story to the kids at Heartland class, to junior high age kids. Tell me a little bit about that approach. Did you come for it from, there's a pop culture element to that right now, so this might engage them, or did somebody come with you and say, there's a pop culture element thing, we know you teach this. How did that work, and what are you going to talk about in that class for that audience?
Sure. Well, again, someone from Heartland asked me if I would be interested in this, and I have to be truly confessional here. I'm more scared of teaching junior high kids than I have been teaching. I just did a series at Illinois State University, not on mythology, but about AI, although I actually began with mythology, because many of our AI ideas come out of mythological telling. But I'm a little more afraid of the junior high kids. But yes, I'm well aware of Percy Jackson. I've read the Percy Jackson books. I've seen the Disney movies. Again, I think that they are wonderful, especially Percy Jackson, because Percy Jackson is still much beloved, even in this generation, and it introduces a whole generation of people to mythology. Do I have to tidy it up a little bit? Yes, I really do. And again, Disney, of course, takes the Hercules story especially, and they have to clean it up. The real story behind Hercules is not even PG. I would put it in the R-rated part of, if we use our rating system, I would put it in the R-rated part. So it needed to be cleaned up. But how lovely that they're introduced to the idea of Hercules at all, to the idea of Hades. Again, Disney cleans up Hades a great deal, but they know about these things when they come to me. And I love that they have some knowledge, and something sparked this interest in them. Mythology at Heartland is not a required course, so the students that take this want to know more about this particular topic.
You mentioned cleaning up the stories, and as we look at, you know, the Judeo-Christian and Hebrew tradition, there's a lot of darkness in some of those stories as well. But there always seems to be some sort of moral punishment element to it, that those are parables that are trying to teach you a lesson about something, even though sometimes the lesson's not exactly clear. When I think about Greek stories, quite often the all-powerful people, the gods, they're doing the bad stuff. They're not the person that's not listening to the gods. They're disregarding everyone else. And I wonder what we can take away from that, in that quite often the perpetrators of sins, for lack of a better word, are the gods.
The Greeks, again, the idea that these stories are being written down, the ones that get to the top during the golden age of Greece, they're full of irony and they're full of humor. And they very deliberately made their gods full of flaws, so that in the one sense they could approach them as gods. And sometimes it's misunderstood that they really did see them as gods. There are temples all over Greece, all over Italy, in any place that the Greeks colonized, to these gods and goddesses. You could go to Mount Olympus. There was no god sitting at the top of the mountain. That was faith, right? You had to believe that they were there, but you could go there. But they made their gods often humorous, often fallible, and their heroes even more so. There is no Greek hero who meets a happy ending, an ultimate happy ending. Pretty much every Greek hero comes to some kind of sad, tragic, murderous, dying alone, that kind of end. They did that so they could have heroes, so they could have things to aspire to, so they could have some moral codes or moral rules. But to say, but guess what? They mess up, we mess up, we can mess up. We can mess up together.
Well, before I let you go, and maybe we've touched on it already, but I wonder if there are any favorites amongst these ancient tales that you can't wait to cut loose on with your students, or you'd want to talk about today.
There are two that come to mind easily, and one is so easy, right? Again, Hercules, who's really Heracles. Why is he Heracles? He's the illegitimate son of Zeus. And when he is born and Zeus decides to make him a famous hero and a demigod, he wants to kind of rub it into Hera. So Heracles in Greek means Hera the Great. He names this illegitimate son Hera the Great. His story is full of flaws. He was a highly flawed person, but the Greeks loved him. He was the number one of the heroes. And then a god that not as many people know about, and that is Hephaestus. For the Romans made him Vulcan. He's our anvil god. He makes iron work. He's been thrown out of heaven by Hera because she hates him. She hates him. She throws him out of heaven. This makes him disabled. This makes him crippled. This makes him ugly. And yet he's married to the most beautiful of all of the goddesses, Aphrodite. And even though he's crippled and ugly and picked on and sometimes is kind of put over on the side table, when the gods need a perfect magical piece of armor that can't be destroyed, when they want something that's made beautiful only for the gods, the most beautiful thing that can be made, who do they turn to? They turn to our crippled, ugly god, Hephaestus. And he is my favorite for that reason. He is an outsider, but he makes beautiful art, and he makes the strongest armor and the best swords. So I love him for that. He is my favorite.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for coming here today and talking about your favorites and talking to us about your career and your love of Greek mythology and how you connect with students. And congratulations on being chosen as the 2025 Outstanding Faculty Member of the Year at Heartland Community College.
Thank you, Steve. I've enjoyed our time together.
Tom McCulley is an Associate Professor of Humanities at Heartland Community College. He talked to us today about Greek mythology and the various iterations of courses that he teaches on that subject. If you're interested in other interviews about history, storytelling, humanities, English literature, and more, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.